From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a look at the unique financing of the Hop streetcar and what it could mean for future expansion. Then a sculptor of stone found herself participating in and curating an exhibit about water.
Stone actually is birthed in water, and it's water that forms stone and forms our landscape.
And the thrill isn't gone for mandolinist Eric Berry of Trampled by Turtles.
The first 5 minutes I'd ever had a mandolin in my hand, there are three things I really loved about it, and those are still the three things I really love about it. You can play chords, you can compose bass lines, and it is an extremely percussive instrument.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Since it was first envisioned, there has been controversy over the Hop streetcar in Milwaukee. One of the central concerns has been about its funding, namely, who's paying for this and could the money be spent on a more worthy cause? The Wisconsin Policy Forum is not picking sides in this debate. Rather, their recent report on the Hop's funding structure is meant to clarify where the funding comes from and how that compares to similar projects in other cities. Rob Henkin is the president of the forum, and Joe Pietrangelo is one of the senior researchers. They join Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about the report and many of the misconceptions around the Hop's funding.
The first thing that you have to look at is the mix of federal versus local funds. So when we think about the initial streetcar line that has already been built, the Hop that's already in operation, as well as the short extension to the lakefront, which has been largely constructed but has not opened for service yet, a mix of roughly half and half federal and local funds. So that's important to understand that these federal funds are funds that were left over, believe it or not, from an appropriation from 1991 that originally was intended for a much bigger transit project in the East-West Corridor, and there ended up being $55 million left that was designated to the city of Milwaukee for a downtown connector-type transportation project. So that half of the roughly $130 million really had to be spent for this purpose. Now, for the local financing, and that's the topic of our report that we have just released, local funds, and there the question is, so to what extent was the decision to use roughly $64 million of local money, was that taking it away from other city services? Was that a direct hit on city property taxpayers? And here's where the fact that the city has been using tax incremental financing means essentially that the answer to those questions is no, though there are also other nuances that may or may not be of concern to taxpayers and to citizens.
So to take a step back, I think TIF funds, we frequently call them TIF, it is tax incremental financing. I think the understanding of that kind of pool of money is pretty lacking. So can you kind of unpack that?
Yeah, I can explain. TIF, typically the way it works is a district will be created. So the boundaries of a certain area of the city will be set as a district. And the value of that district at that point is sort of frozen. So you think of all the taxes that are generated within that district. Those continue to go to the city and the county and the school district just as they did. They'll continue to do that throughout the life of this TIF district. But what's different is any increase that occurs over time. So as the value from new development creates new tax revenue, that additional revenue is called the increment. It's skimmed off the top, essentially, and then that is used to pay for the projects that the TIF district is creating. Typically, you're talking about new infrastructure like new streets or new water infrastructure, cleaning up contaminated properties or things like that. In this case, the money is used for the streetcar system.
And Joy, I would just add, I think an additional consideration that makes it even more complicated for people to understand is, so the traditional way of doing that is you create a new tax increment district And it's that increment, as Joe said, that then finances the cost of the infrastructure that you've developed to encourage the development within that district. In this case, the city is actually using monies from existing tax increment districts that were so successful that they would have closed out prior to the originally anticipated closeout date, which is typically 27 years. And you're essentially keeping those districts open and continuing to use that increment to pay for a project that, while very beneficial to those districts, it isn't a development that was used to encourage economic development that would create the increment in the first place.
Okay, so this is money that really has to be spent on specific things inside of these districts, projects inside of these districts.
Correct. So there is the ability to spend within the district or within a half a mile. So in the case of using these districts, they have to be along the streetcar line or within a half a mile of the streetcar line in order to be used to support streetcar development.
Now, Rob, as you said in the first answer, it's unusual for a development to rely this heavily on TIF funds.
So, yes. So what we did is we looked at, in addition to Milwaukee's, nine other cities who have somewhat recently developed new streetcar systems. And the starting point for the research was just to see how many of those other nine were using TIF as their form of local financing. And so we found that of those nine, there were two others, Cincinnati and Portland, that were using TIF, but the percentage use was much smaller. In those cases, it was roughly 12% for Cincinnati and 8% for Portland. Ours is about 48%. So Milwaukee is the one of these 10, the only one that is using TIF as the essentially the primary local financing tool. There are different mixes of federal versus local in these other cities, but to the extent that local dollars are involved, these other city governments are using other forms of local dollars and not tax incremental financing.
Now, what are the other forms of, you know, local monies that they're using?
Examples are creating special districts. So Kansas City and Atlanta are two cities that have created special districts. So it's similar where there's a geographic area drawn around the streetcar. And then within it, in Kansas City, for example, they created a transportation development district where they're able to levy both a sales tax. So they have a 1% sales tax within the district that is used to support the streetcar, as well as a special assessment that is, so a property tax, a special assessment that's added for all property owners within the district. And so that's how they're funding it. Another way, Oklahoma City has just done a temporary sales tax that is financing a number of different projects. The streetcar is one of several projects that the voters went to the ballot box and voted on and approved. So it's a temporary 1% sales tax that that they've used. We also found other cities have tapped state transportation programs. El Paso, Texas was an example of that, where they were able to get funding from a state program that in Wisconsin, we don't have any sort of transportation program that supports transit, new transit and services being created. In all of those cases, we found that they couldn't be replicated exactly as they are in Milwaukee. The only exception that could even be partially replicated was that Kansas City example I mentioned, in that we could create a district like a business improvement district or neighborhood improvement district that could levy a special assessment on properties. So that would maybe help in some way to finance the streetcar, but it wouldn't be necessarily a full solution. And we can't do a sales tax, and there's no state transportation program currently that we could tap. So that kind of helps to explain why the city used TIF and why we were so much more reliant on TIF than any other city, is that the other options weren't available.
Now, you know, I think we get into this quite a bit when we look at really any project in the state of Wisconsin, but specifically for us, Milwaukee County, the city of Milwaukee, we have a very unique funding structure. When we're looking at this project specifically, what would need to change to make these other forms of funding an option?
So you're correct, Joy. And we've done research looking across the 50 states at the way that states allow their municipalities to generate resources to pay for municipal services. And we happen to be a state in which we make our municipalities highly reliant, specifically our cities, on state aids. And we also very significantly and severely restrict the number of local revenue options available to our municipal governments. Not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's certainly a thing that we have found that makes us somewhat unique. Most other states give their municipalities, if not all of their municipalities, then at least their largest cities, they give them some type of local sales tax authority. And that can be for a variety of reasons, but one that particularly applies to larger cities is that when you think about the users of city services, they tend to be not only city residents, but commuters and visitors and entertainment patrons, et cetera. These are folks that are also using city services. So there's some logic behind having this broader base of the consumers of city services helping to pay for those services. Here, we don't do that. In other cities, as Joe said, in some other cities that have built streetcars, they felt that being able to use a sales tax that actually tapped into ostensibly the economic growth and activity around the streetcar line as people are using the streetcar and getting off the streetcar and frequenting bars and restaurants and stores and spending money, then some of the sales tax they're paying is going back to help fund the project. And so that is one way to look at it as being an equitable, reliable way to generate the dollars to pay for it. Here, we're limited to property taxation. And so, as Joe said, really the options for city government, if indeed, and we're taking no position, but if indeed you're of a mind that we should have built a streetcar and now we should be looking to extend the hop, then the options in terms of issuing debt are either regular general obligation bonds that are backed by the city's general property tax levy, which would be very difficult given all of the competing needs for that property tax levy, or to try to use this type of financing that's relying very directly and specifically on this incremental growth to try to finance it. But there are some weaknesses there. And we think the fact that other cities that also have TIF available to them aren't using it is somewhat indicative of what some of those challenges are. So right now, again, municipalities have no sales tax authority except for a very small percentage who qualify as resort tourism areas. Milwaukee does not. So looking at either a general sales tax, as Oklahoma City did, and even the ability to just ask the voters if they would support that, that would take a change in state law to be able to create a special district that would not just use potentially assessments on property, but also collection of a sales tax, that would require a change in state law.
And also the state transportation program. There was a proposal, the governor's budget, to create a program that would have provided some funding for creating new transit services or for capital transit projects, but that didn't make it into the final budget. So something like that would have to be created for the city to be able to tap a state program.
It seems like a lot of these ideas have been dying in the legislature, essentially. You know, we had that in the governor's budget. It went to the legislature. It seemed like that made its way out. And right now, the Common Council is actually asking for the ability to, you know, have a higher tax. But the political feasibility of that is a little bit questionable. What have been the roadblocks in the past, and what are the current roadblocks to making these changes?
Well, you know, I think, again, there are arguments on both sides of this issue. But I think that what our research is suggesting is that something has to give here. So again, we've set up a structure where we've said to municipal governments, we're going to be very generous in terms of state aid. And indeed, the city of Milwaukee receives roughly $225 million every year in shared revenue from the state of Wisconsin. The problem is that that's the same exact dollar amount as it was receiving 20 years ago. So if on the one hand, you're going to make your municipal governments very reliant on state aid, yet that state aid never grows, and if on the other hand, their second major source of revenue and really the only option is the property tax, and that is restricted, there are levy limits there, then you're creating a very constrained revenue environment for your municipal governments. Now, there are several who would argue, well, that's a good thing. That's going to make them be lean and mean, and our taxes are already too high in the state of Wisconsin. And clearly, there's some benefit. You know, the notion of having some type of state-imposed control on local revenue-raising ability arguably has a benefit. The problem is when that, again, that potential for revenue growth is so constrained that it does not match up with expenditure needs. And so, in essence, it's creating some very difficult financial challenges for municipalities. And given the fact that year after year after year, we have seen this constrained revenue growth, many municipalities across the state are saying this is a problem. Now, here we're talking about a very specific thing, which is economic development. And so on the one hand, the first set of arguments is around just general, how are we going to pay for city services? There's then a whole big set of questions about what type of wherewithal should municipal governments have to invest in economic development, to invest in infrastructure that's needed to encourage economic development? And are you inappropriately shackling their ability to make investments they need to make to grow because of what you're doing on the revenue side under the very understandable pretense of wanting to make sure we have an affordable tax burden. And that's where we are observing that municipalities in Wisconsin, aside from the general question of is the municipal revenue structure broken here, are there enough tools in the economic development toolbox? And again, that can cut either way. In some respects, if you give too many tools, you know, does that encourage too much risk-taking? So again, finding that balance, I think, is part of the key here. But given what we're seeing in other cities, again, if you're of a mind that, a streetcar system is an important economic development investment, that a municipal government the size of Milwaukee should have the ability to make that decision on its own, yet at the same time you're giving them very few tools in their toolbox, they're going to turn to the tools they have. In this case, that tool is tax increment financing, and we've talked about some of the benefits. But to the extent that we're creating new TIFs, it's a relatively risky endeavor, and it really depends on the district itself, and there's lots of factors there. And also, arguably, a streetcar is conveying broader benefits to the general public that go beyond sort of a narrow financing mechanism that is limited to a particular district. And so is that a reason why maybe you'd want to use a different funding source if you had that ability?
Well, Rob, Joe, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Rob Henkin is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher for the forum. He's also the lead author of their recent report on the financing structure for the Hop streetcar in Milwaukee. It was released today. You can find a link to that report at WUWM.com. Henkin and Pietrangelo spoke with Joy Powers. Coming up next, how a sculptor of stone curated an exhibition about water at a museum of fiber arts. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. An exhibition on view at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts through mid-November explores the expressive nature of water. The various materials used by some of the artists, things like stone, zippers, and straws, might be surprising, but the overall effect is a deep meditation on water and its importance. The exhibition was the brainchild of sculptor Susan Falkman. It was helped along by the Quilt Museum's exhibitions curator, Emily Schlemowitz. Both women joined us just as the show was opening in mid-August. Susan and Emily, it is a pleasure to have you both on Lake Effect. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So tell me about this exhibit, Water on Exhibit at the Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. Emily, you're the exhibition's curator there. When did this all start to happen?
So this all started to coalesce actually about 3 years ago with Susan Falkman. And she can tell the story a little bit better about the beginning. So I came in about a year ago and started identifying additional artists to add to the exhibition. So all told, the exhibition has 13 contemporary fiber artists, and it represents sculpture, video, installation, quilts, shibori. So there's really a range of work on display right now.
It's the kind of thing that the museum often will do. There's usually a mix of interesting ways that people work with fiber that include things that are not fiber.
Yeah, we really try to take an expansive definition of fiber art, and that this exhibition really embraces that, as have other exhibitions. So that's really where curatorially I come in and really think about how we're going to mix marble sculpture in with, you know, quilts, and where how those two will intersect.
How they talk to each other.
How they talk to each other.
And Susan, you're the sculptor who's working with marble, right?
Yes.
And so when you 3 years ago were starting to think about this exhibition, what prompted it? What was the impetus behind putting all of this together?
Well, it's really interesting to retrospectively to look back at something that started as just a kind of a glimmer, and then how it evolves into this finished, wonderful exhibition. But it actually started with my feeling compelled throughout the years I've carved to create stone to look fluid like material and water. And so those elements are in all of my work. But in particular, with this piece of stone, when I turned 70, I had just finished a huge couple-ton project. And I went to my studio and thought, I would really love, I just wanted to give myself a challenge. And so I took a 1-inch slab of stone, 2 foot by 2 foot, and decided, okay, I'm going to turn this into looking like a piece of cloth. So that was the beginning of the exhibition. So I created this landscape. And as I carve, I have lots and lots of thoughts about, and water came into my thinking, as it often does. And the title of the piece was What Lies Beneath. Around this time that I was making this slab of stone look like a piece of cloth, I went to an exhibition at the Quilt Museum. And when I came back to my studio, the slab of stone that looked like cloth, I thought, oh, I'm going to divide this into squares, which I did. It became a landscape, which some of my work does, a landscape that where I was just the tiniest little spot on the landscape. Like you're when you're flying through the air and you look down. About this time, one of my favorite photographers came to view my work at the studio, and that was Vicki Reed. And as she was looking at this quilt, she said, oh, I've done some quilts with photography. And she planned to do a quilt piece with photography using little things from the photograph she took in my studio. Okay, so that was the start of it, and you know, that thought.
So it was just a conversation.
Just a conversation. Yeah. Oh, we could maybe do something. Well, then I carved about 6 quilts, and they were all telling a story of water. So after a number of them were done, I contacted the Quilt Museum and said, I've carved this quilt, and I'm wondering if you would be interested in looking at it and maybe talking about a way it could be presented.
And so, Emily, had anyone ever called and said, I've carved a quilt?
No, you know, that's a funny question, yeah. And I think it's intriguing. And when I went to Susan's studio, which is this glorious space over in Mequon off her property, I was really blown away by how marble really can transform. She can really transform marble, and it becomes this really incredible, very light material. And it totally said to me, fabric. So that's really where I got excited. And I thought, you know, this could really be an interesting exhibition if we brought in other artists and really contextualized it within the fiber arts. I think because she did six, you know, we're really going to see her work in context, but we're also going to see some really other incredible work. You know, there's other sculpture, and I wanted to think about how those sculptures utilizing some other unusual materials like zippers can, you know, really convey this sense of water and fabric.
That idea of flowing, that idea of fluidity and movement, and something we don't tend to think of with stone. We tend to think of things, water flowing over it, or we think of lava when stone is in its molten form. But, you know, stone itself we tend to think of as very solid, and to somehow make that transformation is very cool.
Which is interesting, because stone actually is birthed in water. Its whole anatomy, and it's water that forms stone and forms our landscape.
And so they obviously connect.
Yeah.
But I think most of us don't think of it that way. You know,
right.
We think of it, this is solid, this is one thing, and this is another, and they are not, you know, they're not talking to each other in that way. I know Vicky's piece has something to do, is it her grandmother's piece?
Well, in the beginning, when there are two local artists who I really wanted to show with, one was Mary Mendla, who's also was embraced too by Emily, really liked what she was thinking
Wonderful
of doing.
Painter, she is, yeah.
And that when she does her fiber work. And Vicky, she was originally going to do a fiber piece, and then it came to her that she wanted to do this grandmother's piece, which is an amazing concept and quite an endeavor for her. And I see it as a really its own standing exhibition. So she'll have that piece in the show, but it's a book, its own creation. It's really rather a wonderful project.
It's called River of Grandmothers. So it really thinks about water as sort of a metaphor for how lineage, women's lineage within the family. And so she asked friends and family to give her portraits, photographic portraits of their grandmothers, and tell a story about their grandmothers. And then she used a photographic process called cyanotype, which basically exposes a material, a treated fabric, to light and creates this imprint. So you can have the photograph on the actual fabric. And it's very, very long. And then she's going to display it with the stories. So you're really going to have this river of grandmothers and then the individual stories next to it. So it's a really poetic metaphor for family.
Well, I also love what you said earlier, too, about how all of these different materials that we don't tend to think of as specifically fiber are all creating these quilts, that are all creating these tapestries, mm-hmm. that they've all come together in this one exhibition. And so now, Susan, that you've seen all the pieces and you've gotten to be a curator in addition to somebody who's showing in this, are you astounded by the complexity and the variety of the work that you're seeing?
I just love the way it's come together. And co-curating the collaborative process with Emily has been just, it's so positive and so wonderful. We like kind of flow together as we work on the project. But that's what I mean. You look back retrospectively and see that path, like the path water takes as it etches across the land, the path that this idea took.
And so how many artists are represented in this?
So there are 13 artists. Some are local. There are actually quite a few local. And then some are from Chicago. And then some are global. So we actually have an artist from Japan, Akiko Ike, who installed these beautiful large-scale carp in our museum atrium. So when you walk in, you're actually going to be greeted by these carp that hang from the museum ceiling. And she uses this process that she calls chiku-chiku, which is basically an onomatopoeic word to describe the thread going into the fabric. They're just lovely. And she was here actually to give a workshop on her process. And then, you know, when you go upstairs, there's going to be this incredible entryway to water.
I want to thank both of you so much for taking the time, coming down and telling us about it, and best of luck with it.
Thank you.
Sculptor Susan Faulkman is an exhibitor in and the co-curator of Water, the current exhibit at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. Emily Schlemowitz is the museum's exhibition curator and co-curator of this exhibit. The show runs through mid-November. There's more information at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then catch up with the only Wisconsin member of Trampled by Turtles ahead of their performance in Sheboygan this Friday. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. With more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, I'm Bonnie North. For 15 years, the Minnesota string band Trampled by Turtles has played bluegrass instruments like the banjo and mandolin as if they were in a rock band, driving and intense. Their music is rooted in folk traditions, but it borrows from many other genres as well. The band took a brief break before they released their latest album, Life is Good on the Open Road, last year. Well, they're touring now, and they'll be at the Stephanie H. Weil Center in Sheboygan this Friday. The only Wisconsinite in Trampled by Turtles is mandolin player Eric Berry. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone to talk about how things have changed for him and the band over the years.
Eric Berry, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks for taking a few minutes to speak with me today.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
You are the mandolin player in Trampled by Turtles, and as a string band, you don't view yourselves as bluegrass players, but has the audience seen that change over the past, you know, over 15 years you've been a group?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. Because I definitely know what I think about the music we play and where it fits into the bluegrass continuum, but I'm not, there's a lot of people who, like, were their first string band, and then through us, they discover other ones. And so if the first band you hear is Trampled by Turtles, and then you hear Yonder Mountain String Band, and then you hear Bill Monroe, does it sound radically different? I don't know. That's not my experience. So I know what makes the music I play very different. But I really don't know if other people hear it. You know, it's sort of like anything else, like when you're that intimately involved with it, you see all the warts and flaws and all that, and other people, they don't.
That's fair, though. I mean, in... even though you've been together as a group for pretty long, you know, I imagine you mentioned you will always see the warts, the bad things, or the compositions you wish were slightly different or something like that.
Sure.
But how have you all evolved together as you've worked out your group dynamic? Has any roles shifted? How do you think you've grown musically to continue to push the envelope of your sound?
I think a lot of it, it's really hard to talk about a lot of it because we don't talk about a lot of that. There's a lot of unspoken musical communication, even through the years. Dave Simonette, our lead singer and guitar player, is probably the most verbal about wanting to go in a certain direction or wanting to avoid a certain direction. But even then, he's not saying, Eric, I want you to do this here, and then when it goes here, I want you to do this, and then when it goes to this part, you know, he's never, ever been that specific. He might just kind of be more like, hey, can you do something a little more ringy? You get what I mean? And then it's still kind of up to me to figure out how to do that. But as we've worked together for so long, we've learned each other's feel. And then I think we're all trying not to be repetitive. But there's definitely a groove that, like, Ryan Young, our fiddle player, and I will get into when he's playing leads and I'm trying to back him up. And I'm, quite frankly, I'm trying to back him up exactly the way my jazz guitar teacher in high school, Roger Brotherhood from Madison, told me to do it. Try to play with that trumpet player's mouth with your right hand. You know what I mean? And I'm trying to play with Ryan's bow with my right hand. And it's the first time ever since Roger told me that 25 years ago that it works.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my, that's terrific advice.
Yeah. Like, funny how that works out.
Right. But, I mean, there's a lot of unspoken stuff there, which is, first and foremost, that me and Ryan work well together because everybody in Trampled works well together. Part of what it is like that unspoken chemistry that musicians can have.
Yeah, and I think it's quite a testament to that chemistry of your group to be together this long and still, you know, have the need for no communication, or you're communicating through feel. So yeah, as you've evolved and put out new albums, do you find that your studio sessions have changed, or just that it's the same technique, just the songs are different?
I think it's more of the same technique. The most recent record we made, Life is Good on the Open Road, you know, that one we made after taking like a 19-month, well, I guess when we got back into the studio, it had been about a year hiatus. And that was where we learned the negatives of unspoken communication, because just because musically we are communicating pretty well by feel, professionally and personally, we need to use words. And so we kind of got ourselves into a place where, you know, we needed to take some time away from the grind and the road and, quite frankly, each other, although it has all worked out. So when we got back into a space together to make that record, there was sort of this sense of, like, at any given time, are we going to have to talk about something? Do you know what I mean? And it didn't come up, but I think there was that sort of sense of, like, we might have to change our game plan. But instead, we kept saying it was like riding a bike, because that's what it felt like. It was like, oh my God, you know, like, this is like when we made our first record. Just, it's very comfortable and natural and easy to play music together. And we just sort of let that happen. One kind of funny thing that happened on one tune on the new record is Ryan was doing some overdubs of some fiddle parts on the song Blood in the Water, and not everybody was in the control room listening. And then I think it was Dave who was sitting in the chair next to our engineer, was like, I gotta go to the bathroom. Eric, you sit in this chair. And then suddenly, by sitting in that chair, when Ryan got done with a part, he was like, Eric, what'd you think? And when I was sitting on the couch behind Dave, he wasn't asking me what I thought, although I certainly had the right and the freedom to be like, hey man, I think whatever, right? But suddenly I felt put on the spot.
We don't do that here.
But it was just sort of a funny little moment there where it's like, oh, you know, like if you're sitting here in the chair looking through the glass watching the guy do it, you're a little bit in charge, you know? Like,
sure. If I just stand in here, you know?
But I think what it really was is he wasn't 100% certain, and he looked up through the window and there I was, so he was just like, what'd you think?
Yeah.
Also, baby, thin in here. I don't know what you were thinking. There's always trouble whenever you walk through the door. Activate the lights on the side if you feel like you're sinking. I don't know if I can take it anymore. Blood in the water, we're getting out of here. Blood in the water, we're getting out of here.
Well, and to have that break is obviously important, because the life of a touring musician is not an easy one. And you guys have been together for so long that I imagine, obviously, your personal lives have changed. I'm sure there's marriages, there's children. So how do you personally see your work-life balance? And how have you been able to recognize your needs or shift things around with that of a group?
Well, you know, as we got bigger and we started hiring crew, a lot of those guys had worked with larger national acts who are based out of L.A. or New York or Nashville. And what they would tell us is, if you're based out of New York and you're going to do a West Coast run, that's 3 or 4 days just to get there, just to get there. And then you play the coasts, and maybe you're going to do some stuff in the Northwest or whatever, and then you got to go home, and that's another 3 or 4 days, unless you fly. So there you go. There's like a week and a half that's not gigs. Right? But when you're coming out of Minnesota, that's cut in half. And so it allowed for us to kind of go out for a couple weeks and go back and then take a break and then go out for a couple weeks and go back and take a break. And so that put into a balance of roughly 2 weeks on, roughly 2 weeks off. In practice, it became a lot more like 3 weekends on, like 17 days on, and then the rest of the month off. And, you know, it's not always easy. And I do miss stuff, and I'm not around for stuff where it sure would be handier for my family if Dad was there. But, you know, we've never had a situation where, like, I haven't seen my kids in 7 weeks and what's going on at home. That's never happened. So it does keep it balanced pretty well. You know, and speaking just for myself, I know that there are lots of other fathers who are home a lot less and work a job they dislike a lot more.
Being a mandolin player and being in Trampled by Turtles, that's pushing the envelope with sound and has a lot of quick-paced, rigorous music. I'm just curious, does the performance shelf life of your instrument change and is shorter compared to, you know, say a mandolin player that plays other genres of music, or do you find yourself replacing strings far more often than would be required?
Oh, geez. In the early days, I used to break strings. So they're probably replaced more often than they need to be at these days, because there's just nothing more hard than, I mean, literally, like, breaking a string, like, every three songs, and then before having a crew or even a quality backup instrument, like, having to sit out a song to replace it, or having the band have to tread water while I'm trying to replace it. So, you know, I mean, a lot of that, though, is instrument quality and instrument setup and stuff like that, and over the years, I've learned a lot more. So if I were to take the instrument the literal instrument I'm using today, and then send it back in time to 2006, I'd be curious what would happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Well, and what have you learned from the mandolin playing it for 16 years with this group? What does it continue to teach you?
You know, that's a interesting thing, because the first 5 minutes I'd ever had a mandolin in my hand, there are three things I really loved about it, and those are still the three things I really love about it. And that is, you can play chords, you can compose bass lines, but because it's so high in pitch, you do not interfere with a bass player, or even a guitar player for that matter, or even a banjo player for that matter, because you're just higher in pitch than they are. And thirdly, it is an extremely percussive instrument, because of how much pressure there is on the top of it. And for the 20 years I've been playing it, I've learned how to manipulate that and work with it and do stuff with it and get all kinds of shadings and subtleties out of it. But at the end of the day, there is something that went through my head when I first played it, and I was like, oh boy, this thing's great. And that still is there.
Yeah, pick it up. It's never dark and it doesn't feel right. The bars are always full and the people are so pretty. Hollow little vessels that survive on the lights. Vaguely rolling hills and a sleepy little sunrise. I even slept a little bit last night. Some populated people, they are waiting for salvation. I've never been there, but I heard that it's death. Here we go, like death can't touch us tonight.
And I think people are hopefully getting a little more exposure to more string instrumentation, different ways of making these things sound. You know, for the first time, people like Brandi Carlile finally had her Grammy performance. And, you know, she's not quite strictly country. You know, she kind of pushes the envelope in that way, too. Or, you know, Chris Thiele, as a mandolin player, is hosting a show live from here.
Right.
And he's bringing in so much more music exposure to that audience. So do you think that these alternative categories of music that these artists are bringing is opening people's collective minds on what it means to construct your own sound in an industry so defined by genre?
I think so, because, you know, my personal history is I spent a lot of years as a really dedicated guitar student, both classical and jazz, and then I played rock guitar for fun. And the influence that different sorts of guitar musics have had on me is just inescapable. It's just inescapable. There's just absolutely no way to avoid the fact that I spent years of my life trying to learn every Eddie Van Halen song and a whole bunch of Black Sabbath songs, and I learned how to play jazz. You cannot escape that, right? But I play mandolin, so it just sounds different. It just does, you know, because it does. And I can't imagine that I'm a unique person in that regard. I mean, it's just there's no way that I accept that. So to me, it's like you have people who are music fans and then pick up an instrument that maybe doesn't feature prominently in their favorite music, but they pick it up for one reason or another. Their father owns a banjo. They have to play a band instrument, and they get the saxophone, whatever it happens to be. And then there's other music they like, and if they ever start like trying to make their own on the instrument that they've been drawn to, but the music they've been drawn to maybe isn't that instrument's music, something unique has to happen. It just does. Because I don't think I do anything. If I were playing electric guitar, I'm not doing anything weird at all.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Like, it's totally normal. But it's because I'm playing it on a mandolin. And then for that matter, Dave Carroll, our banjo player, same thing, but on the banjo. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of our bass player, Tim, who has never been a guitar player in a band, all the rest of us have been guitar players in a band at least once. And one of us still is. That's Dave. and I've seen Ryan play electric guitar with Dave. I've seen Banjo Dave play electric guitar in a band. You know, and that influence, it's just there. And I can see why bluegrass players, or you know, bluegrass traditionalists, are annoyed by that. Because the old school bluegrass guys, they weren't rock and rollers, one. And two, they played their instrument from when they were kids. So their banjo influences were banjo players. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. That there's a certain part of me that I wonder what a parallel life would be like if I'd never played guitar music but was still a dedicated musician. You know what I mean? But I'll never know what that life is.
Well, and your band kind of envelops all of those things, which is what adds that dynamic sound. And in a world that, you know, continues to be filled with new tech and auto-tune and all the new tricks and toys of the music industry, what do you think makes acoustic music stand the test of time and still appeal to people?
You know, at some level, I think the fact that, you know, if you were to get all six of us trampled guys into a room without any electricity and we were to play a song, it would sound a lot like one of our concerts. It would hopefully sound a lot like one of our records. If you were to take Radiohead and put them into a room without any electricity and have them play one of their songs, it would sound very different. It might sound very appealing, but it would not sound like their record, and it would not sound like their live show. And that's not a judgment. That's just an observation of fact. And I think people, both the musicians and listeners, tend to sort of equate that you could just do this without electricity, so therefore it's a much simpler, pure, direct line between your fingers and your heart and your mind and the sound. Now, the reality is there's a lot of electricity involved with putting on a Trampled by Turtles show or recording a Trampled by Turtles record, and so there's actually a lot more tricks involved to try and make it sound like it's not there. But I think there's this perception that it's pure. Certainly, in my opinion, when you're hearing an acoustic instrument, even if you're hearing it through pickups and a PA system, you're hearing the interaction of like wood and metal and air. And when you're hearing an electric guitar or a digital keyboard, it's, you know, an electric guitar does have some physical, actual acoustic stuff happening with its strings, but like a digital keyboard, there's really nothing happening. You're kind of triggering computer samples. Now, a person with musical ability can trigger that with taste and with talent, and it sounds great. But I feel like there's this disconnect there that just your brain, like even the way I'm talking about it, I'm not trying to be disrespectful about it. You know what I mean? And I feel like the words I've said are a little bit describing a purely digital keyboard versus an acoustic instrument and how your brain interacts with it. I feel like trying to be respectful, I'm still a little bit not, because at a very base level, it's not the same thing. And I feel like people's brains recognize that. Now, there's a flip side to that. There's stuff those instruments can do that like acoustic instruments can't, and some of that stuff's awesome. So, you know, I'm gonna tip my hat there.
You know, like, of course.
Especially some of those notes that are lower than anything a literal instrument can make.
Mm-hmm.
but it is not too low to be heard or experienced by a stereo system. I'm really a fan of that stuff. And there's a lot of electronic drone music that's really fascinating, like how it like makes at least my brain feel. So there's good stuff there, and I don't mean to like be putting it down, but I think that that's kind of the answer to your question, that there's a perception of purity, whether it's really pure or not, is up for debate.
You said in your last interview here on Like Effect with my colleague Bonnie North that you like either a brand new song or one that's been on the road for some time that you really know. So if that's still the case for you, what's your current song that's hitting that sweet spot?
That is still the case. These new songs off the new record, like, they're a lot of fun to play. You know, Wait So Long has kind of hit a point where I really, really like playing that song. And I'm not really sure why, because it's sort of the one that's easiest for us to be like, oh, everyone's yelling Wait So Long at us. You know? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's something about that one's hard to play and everyone wants it so much that combination is really cool. Because that's if there's one song that really shouldn't get train wrecked, you know, that's the one, right?
I'd say so, yeah. Well, great. Eric Berry, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I truly enjoyed it, and I'm sure all the Wisconsinites are looking forward to having you guys at the Weill Center in Sheboygan.
Yep, thank you so much.
Eric Berry plays the mandolin for Trampled by Turtles. They'll play in Sheboygan at the Stephanie H. Weill Center on Friday. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Mayon Silver this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.